1936, you guys, tell me about, like, the fall turnouts or the goals of the crew that year. Did Al say to you guys, we're going to the Olympics, or do you remember, did you have that goal set aside from the beginning, or?
Yeah. After that 35 thing, the whole squad just became one after that terrible year. And we knew we had a lot of good men, because we had that freshman crew that was so big that I talked about quite a bit. Became the sophomore crew. There were people from there, and the next year had a good freshman crew, and there was a lot of really first-rate oarsmen around, and we had a lot of confidence that we could have a good crew. And I don't recall Ulrichsen or Tom Bowles or anybody else in the coaching capacity or from the university or even alumni saying, oh boy, this is Olympic year, let's go to the Olympics. I don't remember any elderly man or woman saying anything about it, including the coaches. We must have, because we all knew that that was what it was, Olympic year, so we were going to do our best. But one day in April, Ulrichsen had his crews, had his squad all mixed up, just getting going again. And one day he put an outfit together that ultimately became the varsity crew, except for one man. He had a fellow named Mert Hatch at 7. And I can remember putting the boat in the water, running back up. The manager's always to hold the shell there, but I didn't have to do any of that. And I would run back up with him and help put the grease on the oar lock, and they got their oars, came back down, and then they sort of stand around for a minute until we shove off, and somebody said, hey, this thing can go. And we kind of looked around and thought, yeah, maybe it can. We went out and did go pretty well, went really well. And then the next day he shifted Rance into 7. And the boat just, we knew we had a boat that quick. And that boat continued to go. But that isn't what you asked about. But it's a prelim to what I'm going to say. I don't know exactly who it was. I don't know whether it was one of the oarsmen or me or who it was. But we had a slogan. LGB, and it meant let's go to Berlin, and it meant also let's get better. So that when I would yell LGB, that had a double meaning. It meant let's row better, but it also meant and let's go to Berlin at the same time. And it was a wonderful slogan. And so from the time, I'd say, from the time, maybe 2 or 3 days after that book was put together, that was our slogan.
And so you raced Cal, and you beat them handily. And
you know, I don't even remember anything about that race.
Was it here? I don't remember. I don't recall.
I don't remember anything about it.
Yeah, you know.
I don't even remember how far ahead we were.
One of those things where they. No, it doesn't matter. So you then went to Poughkeepsie.
Yeah.
And tell me about that race.
Well, that was the most peculiar race. none of the three races, four races that we had after the Cal race, none of those races were typical. Each one was extremely different. At Poughkeepsie, Ulrichsen had told us to take a semi-racing start, 4 miles downstream, so it was equivalent to about 3.5 miles dead water.
Well, that race was raced downstream?
Yeah.
I was wondering about that. The time seemed fast to me when I was looking. Okay. So
well, it was about a 3.5 mile
okay.
race.
Okay. Downstream, 4 miles.
And time wise.
Yeah.
And he told us to roll about 31.
Okay.
And so we started out, and the stroke went down almost within the first minute to about 29.
Did you have a watch?
Yeah. Strapped to my leg. And I timed them, and they were down further than I had hoped out of a racing start. We walked 29, and it even went down as low as 28. And so, by little tricks of the trade, which you know, you try to get throat back up without telling them to raise it. Didn't work. It would go up to maybe 1 or 1.5 strokes, right back down again.
Were you behind?
And we got behind about 8 lengths.
Jeez.
And I knew it. I knew we were behind a long ways, but I had a choice to make. Either I tell them that we were behind and had to raise a stroke, or I didn't. I chose not to. Because I thought, gee, they aren't even breathing hard. They're just rowing so well. It was just perfect.
Who was the crew that was in front? Was it Cal?
Who was the crew that was what?
In front. Was it Cal?
Oh, I don't remember. Okay. No, I don't think it was Cal.
Okay.
Somebody like Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I couldn't even tell who they were. 8 links out there. And so I tried to raise the stroke for those little innuendos, but it didn't work. But I let them go. Until about 1.5 miles to go. And we were still behind by 5 or 6 lengths. The other crews that were way out there had changed as to who was the leader. And at that point, I told him to raise the stroke to 34 and don't get below it. We're going to race a 2,000 meter. And the stroke went up to 34 just immediately, and we took off. And we just flew by.
Was that about 1.5 miles left in the race? A mile?
Well, I told him it was about 1.5 miles, but the 2,000 meters is about 1.25 miles.
So that brings up an interesting question. I always wondered, how do you practice for a 4 mile race, but then also practice for a 2,000 meter race?
In 1936, that crew, this is my honest belief, without any embellishment, I think they're the best rowing crew that ever existed. They were practically letter perfect, rowing the best style rowing's ever known. After the time trial at Poughkeepsie, which we had to row upstream, it was at night. It was pitch black, gone to a movie. It was so rough. The wind calmed down. And after the time trial was over, we turned around and headed for the Shell House, which is on the other side of the river. And all three crews were together and started out, just going 26, maybe 27, just going home. We got so far ahead of those other two crews, I couldn't even hear them. And Ulrichsen had to stop us going across the mile wide river, had to stop us about 3 or 4 times because he couldn't see us anymore. And was afraid to sit out there all by himself. But you couldn't hear anything. You couldn't hear anything except the oars going in the water. It'd be a, that's all you could hear. The oar lock didn't even rattle on the release. Maybe a month before, he'd say, Hey, just try just a little outward pressure in the oar. And you kept the oar locked, the butt, you know, the neck, the collar. Kept the collar right against the oar lock. He couldn't even hear the oar lock move. They rode so well. And I think it was just the style of rowing. It wasn't that you changed to row 2,000 meters. It was the style of rowing that you could just row any stroke the same way.
That's awesome.
All you did when you went above about 35 was cut the length of the slide.
I'm going to see how much tape I have left here. Okay.
We started out in the usual fashion, not trying to row too fast to start with. But we started out at 40 and took it down immediately after a minute to about 35. And when we got down that way, the Pennsylvania club crew was ahead. And so we just stayed that way, clear up till about, at least the first 500 or 600 meters. And, well, more than that, probably about 700 or 800. And at that point, decided to make a move. And so I gave the crew a big 10, or maybe big 20 for a while, but gave them a silent 10 so the other crew wouldn't necessarily hear it. And told the fellows that we were going to, that Roger was even with the stroke oar. And I said, get me the seven, get him the seven man. In two strokes, we had the seven man. I said, now we got the seven man. We walked right up. Just said, Roger's got 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And now I've got the coxswain. And we walked up it again. And we just about every two strokes we made a seat. Until we were about three quarters of a length ahead. And by then it was getting to the point where we cut out and sprinted. I don't think we gained any more in the sprint, but we beat them by about three quarters of a length. But actually, the men actually hurt themselves walking up their other crew's seat by seat.
All right, so basically let's talk about the race. So everybody lines up. Were there any false starts or anything?
No. Remember, the wind's up this way.
Yeah.
Very strong. And the starter is in the middle of the course.
Okay.
And so he talked with a microphone into the wind, directly into the wind. He probably thought, if I talk directly into the wind, these guys can hear and these guys can hear. Mm-hmm. It didn't work that way. We couldn't hear a word he said. And with this stiff wind like this, Roger and I were having a heck of a time keeping the boat straight.
Yeah.
And I'd glance over every once in a while, see if what the others were doing. And I kept a straight boat as best I could with Roger. Roger and I were, yeah. And so they were pretty well set. So I told them they better get ready for a start. And I didn't know when they were going to start. And I looked down there and I guess I said, well, it looks like we're about ready. That's about the only command I gave them. But I happened to look down there, and just as I looked, they took off down here in the Germans and the Italians and maybe the crew in third lane. I could see them starting to move out. So as fast as I could turn my head, I said, ready all row. And we took off. by that time we were a little bit behind. That didn't really make the difference. We weren't enough behind to, well, you know, 5 feet, 6 feet.
Okay.
And we rode, took off with a regular start, but which is always not very fast, but usually was sufficient. This time we got further behind, and with about 300 meters gone, we were quarter of a length behind, and obviously dropping behind more. And with about 500 meters to go, or 500 meters gone, 1,500 meters to go, we were half a length behind. And it was pretty obvious to me that if we continued to roll at about the 34, 35, well, about 35 or 36, we were going to lose. So I yelled at Don to take the stroke up. I knew we had to do something. So I told him to take the stroke up. And no response. And his eyes were closed. His jaw was open. And I thought, gee, what the hell's going on? And I kept trying to get the stroke up, yelling right, you know, how close he is, yelling right in his face to take the stroke up. And we were rolling about 35, 36, which was usual for us. And no reaction at all. And that continued. I yelled at Don and nothing happened. Eyes still closed, mouth wide open, jaw slack, no expression in his face.
Were you also talking to the rest of the crew at all? I mean, were you telling them where they were?
I was too worried about Don. I was trying too much to get the stroke up. Joe probably heard me. And, well, maybe they heard me, but I didn't pay any attention to them. They were rolling well. They were together. And so one of them was washed out a little bit. What the hell? At this stage of the game, so what?
So now you're 750, 800 meters into the race. What's going on?
Still trying to get them to...
How far ahead is... who's leading right now?
By the time we hit the halfway mark, we were probably behind a length and a quarter, length and a half.
Who's ahead?
I don't know. All I know is that there were crews about a length and a half ahead of us. And they were far over there. Whether Germany was ahead or Italy ahead, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And even the English were ahead of us. And they were right along, they were in the next lane. And I thought, what the hell am I going to do? And I thought, well, only thing I can think of was to have the seven-man stroke rule. So I made up my mind and I tried again. But with 800 meters to go, I decided I had to do it. And of course, that was a hell of a risk. Because either Don would feel it and be able to go in,
or you're
dead in the water. One or the other. So I decided that I had to do it. So I made up my mind that on the next stroke I was going to tell him, during the next stroke. And when that happened, when I'd made up my mind, when the recovery, Don's eyes popped open and his jaw clamped shut, and by golly, away we went. Why he did it at that particular moment, who knows? God helped us.
So that was with about 800 meters left?
Yeah, it was only about 800 meters left, and we were about a length and a half behind. Of course, don't forget now, we're out here rowing in a headwind, well, a strong quartering wind, and they were rowing behind this promontory, dead water, no wind. Well, when we started to go, we started to come up on them. And at the 500 meters to go, they came out from behind the promontory. And then things started to change in a hurry. And we just walked right by them. It just flew by him. How Don ever did it, I don't know.
And
we never rode higher than 42. And I know we went over 44 Maybe we were 45, 46.
In the last 300 meters?
Oh, no, not that long. Last 100.
Were you ahead or behind with setting 300 meters to go?
Behind.
How far?
I can't tell you. I would guess with 300 meters to go, we were probably 3/4 of a length.
Behind.
And for the first time in my life, I lied to him. First time, I'd been coxing this outfit for a whole year.
Right.
And I'd been coxing for 3 years before that, never lied to him.
The whole thing's about trust and it.
But I lied to him then. I started out by telling him it was 30 strokes to go. And we went about 22, and I told him it was 26 to go.
and
I kept doing that. I told him it was 20 strokes to go, and we probably had about 25 to go.
And so you could see that you guys were moving.
Oh yeah, we were coming up awful fast.
And you had already passed the Brits.
Passed what?
The Brits. You knew when you passed Great Britain.
I didn't know.
You don't remember that.
I don't even remember after the first 400 meters, I don't even remember where Great Britain was. Because I completely ignored the other crews for about 700 or 800 meters.
Did you know you had won when you crossed the finish line?
We crossed the finish line and Don fell flat face forward. And I splashed water on him. He was totally exhausted, absolutely. And after maybe 10 or 15 seconds, maybe 30 seconds, one of the guys said, "Did we win?" And I said, "I think so, but I'm not sure." And then finally they announced it.
In German was the announcement of the...
No.
It was in English?
Yeah. They might have announced it in German first.
And so when you heard that you had won, where did the guy start hooping and hollering?
No.
Or?
Absolutely not. Huh?
And who was it that said, "If I ever work that hard again, I'll make $1 million"?
Jim McMillan, after we got out of the shell. No, nobody, no. Usually the crew would raise its hand.
Right.
Nobody.
Why?
They couldn't have taken two more strokes. The boat would have stopped.
So you sat there, and then you finally rowed into the dock.
We rode back up. They asked us to go back up in front of the
grandstand.
We rode back up there and then came back.
And you pulled into the dock.
Let me go back a minute. I don't think I've ever seen a crew totally exhausted. Totally. Except that one instance. They absolutely, I don't think they could have taken two more strokes. They'd have collapsed. They were utterly exhausted. They couldn't raise their arms.
And when you got back to the dock, was Al there?
Yeah.
And what he said?
Al was there, and Parnell was there, and Pocock was there. Yeah. I get a little emotional about this when I think of him, thinking of men. They were so tired. They had a wreath that they put over my shoulders, and then I took it off and put over Don's shoulders, and Don took it off, put over, and handed it to Don. He put it on his shoulders. Then he put it over his head to Joe and went up the boat that way. And we all sat there. Didn't get out of the boat until all that was done. And by that time, I think Al and the rest of George and Parnell realized how exhausted they were, and they just helped the guys get out of the shell and said, "Congratulations, well done, wonderful," but no exuberation. Nobody. It was. I don't even remember anybody behind those three or four people at our manager who was there. I remember people, but I don't even remember anybody yelling or hollering or saying, yelling at us anything. These guys were too exhausted. And they showed it. Gotta stop.
It's a fantastic story.
Yeah, it really is.
It is.
But I don't think any group of men have ever been as exhausted as they were.
So, take the boat out of the water, put the boat away. Did you see Al smile? You know, this is the.
Oh, after you put the boat away and took your shower, they had a chance to recoup a little bit. Then they were sort of smiling.
And then there were interviews, I imagine.
Nope.
No.
We got in the bus and went back to our quarters. No interviews.
And tell me what happened after that.
Well, we stayed in our quarters that night. We didn't even go anywhere.
Did you talk to any of the guys?
You talked to any outsiders?
No, to Joe or to you know, to any
of
the guys.
We talked amongst ourselves.
Yeah, and said, wow, that was an incredible race, and can you believe that?
Well, mostly it was how you feeling.
A lot of these guys, you know, from what I've read and heard, they don't remember the race.
No, they don't. Were they smart? I don't know, but they don't.
Was Hitler there?
I don't know.
Did you ever see him?
Only twice. Once, when we were lined up on the first day of the Olympic Games, when you march into the stadium, we were all, if this is a stadium here, mm-hmm. and the gate you go through is here, mm-hmm. and there was ropes, this is a big flat area, just completely flat, big one, and there were ropes down the side. And we were all lined up here and over here by the way you go into the stadium, which is alphabetical. Mm-hmm. And we were the last ones on this side, and the Germans were the last ones on this side. And we were ahead of them when you get in line. Mm-hmm. And so here comes a whole group of people in a line down here with a lot of people behind them. And this was the Hitler and his cabinet, Goebbels and whoever, all the rest of them, and a lot of other people. And I don't know who were the rest of them. And here were all of these high muckabucks behind them. And all these guys, when they would come along, they'd stand up straight, you know, and look straight ahead, stand at attention. This group got close enough to where we could see them, we didn't stand at attention. We broke ranks. And we were up here, but here there was quite a ways to go before you went through the gate. We broke ranks and went alongside the rope down here and watched them. And so I saw Hitler that time. And then we got back in line and went like this. So that was one time. And another time, Al took us to some preliminaries. And Jesse Owens was running, and Metcalf. And I think Hitler was in his box that day. And I think saw him, but I'm not sure. And then I'm not sure of that, but I saw him in his box either that day or the day we got the medal.
And so, so you guys then got back on the ship and came home.
No, we didn't. Ray Ekman was there too, mm-hmm. all this time. Mm-hmm. He probably was one of the guys on the dock. Mm-hmm. He passed out $25 and a railroad ticket to wherever we were going to catch a bus, a railroad ticket and a ferry ticket and another railroad ticket, and 20 and in England, I think. No, just an English channel. Railroad ticket, $25, and a railroad ticket from New York to Seattle. And we were just, that was it. Joe went straight home. Roger and Charlie and I bought a bicycles and traveled as far south as Naples by bicycle. We'd take a train trip to the top of a mountain or a hill or something, right, ride down the other side. And we had quite a trip. We went to Venice and Rome and went down as far as Naples, back up through Pisa, back into France, and across the English Channel to England, and then went to New York, took a bus to Detroit, got a car that we'd arranged for previously from Packard people, and they gave it to us to drive to Seattle. And we wanted to drive to Seattle to see a football game. And Washington was playing in Seattle at the stadium. Some southern school, and we wanted to get there in time to see it. And we drove that Packard very nicely. We were good. They told us to drive it 500 miles at some speed, not over some speed. After that, it didn't make any difference driving anymore. And we drove that thing, stopped only to eat. And when a driver was ready to be relieved, he'd raise himself up off the seat by the steering wheel, the other guy'd slip under and then go back. And we drove there. And we beat train time by 12 hours. And we came up in front of the stadium on the day of the game, Saturday, the day of the game, at noon. And the game was in California.
That is funny.
So we each called a gal, went, picked up the three girls, and drove to the beach.
No, that's funny. So now, did you go back to school that next year? Did you stay in school, or what did you do?
Well, I was offered to
coach. You were a coach. Yeah, you were a freshman coach, right? Because Tom left.
Tom left. Bud Rainey and I were appointed assistant coaches, and we week on and week off, we shifted. 1 week I'd have the lightweights, Bud would have the freshmen. Next week he'd have the lightweights, and I'd have the freshmen.
Now, was Bud's name Walter?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bud Rainey.
Okay. Where did he go on? He coached somewhere else.
Columbia.
Right? He coached at Columbia. Okay, so you guys would do switch off and on. And did you coach the freshmen then in 1937?
Just like
with
half
Bud.
Time.
Okay, with Bud, you coached the freshmen.
37, 38, and 39.
Okay, and then you went to MIT.
That's right.
And how long did you coach at MIT?
5 years.
How'd you like that?
Liked it fine.